Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. There's not often figures that I come across or seen their traces across the media field that I go, this person has to be on Expanding Mind. There's many people that interest me, that intrigue me, but occasionally there's somebody who triangulates certain obsessions of the show, of my own personality, in a way that demands their presence in this space. Today's guest is one of those characters because he features three fascinating elements that draw me, again, both personally and intellectually in terms of this show. One is that he is a fascinating manner of religious thinker, a divinity-trained theologian who has served as a professor of religion and has gotten degrees in theology and the New Testament, but one who approaches it from a very interesting angle that we'll be talking about. His latest book is Preaching Deconstruction and shows how religion continues to be an object of worthy investigation, even if one gives up on many of the assumed attitudes and beliefs that have traditionally been associated with being, well, not just religious, but even specifically a Christian, and how Christian texts continue to be valuable to read and reread and pull and tug and turn upside down, a practice that I continue to do throughout my life, even though we don't talk about Christianity too much on this show, because many of the topics that we deal with tend to be found outside of the framework of certainly traditional Christianity. It nonetheless remains a vital point of interest to me, and I know to Maja as well. So you might be thinking, okay, yeah, but there's 1,000 people who are talking about new ways of thinking about Jesus, the historical Jesus, the deconstructed Bible, whatever. But our guest today, Robert M. Price, is not just an interesting theologian. He is also an expert on the works of H.P. Lovecraft. In fact, the first time I came across his name was in some writing that he did, very good writing, about Lovecraft, and he's sensitive to the peculiar spirituality of the Lovecraft universe, and not just in the sense that there's a lot of occult weirdness in the Master's tales, but really some more kind of existential dimensions to the vision of desolation and dread. But if this were not enough, that there was a Christian theologian and deconstructionist out there with a deep and abiding fascination in love for Lovecraft, as if that were not enough for our show, there's a third element to Mr. Price, which is that he co-authored with his wife Carol a book about the progressive rock band Rush. And that's the point where all the lights flare, and we got to get him on the show. So I'm incredibly happy that we have him here today. And that will, I don't know if we'll get to Rush, but the triumvirate there is going to make for a fine chat. But before we bring Mr. Price on, or Dr. Price, or Preacher Price, we're going to bring on, of course, our co-host here, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
So of all those topics, we could say something about all of them, but I'm most curious whether you ever listened to Rush. I mean, Rush is Rush is one of those bands where if you go see them, the line at the men's bathroom is longer than the women's bathroom.
For sure. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I absolutely have listened to Rush. First of all, I'm Canadian, and I think Rush is like the only rock band in the world if you live in Canada, certainly if you did when I was living there. So it's kind of like mandatory listening for all Canadians. But also, the subject matter is about wizards and forests and magical things. So you have to understand, as a person who's inclined to these things, Rush becomes this perfect symbol for that entire world. But I had no idea that our guest today had written that book, so it's funny you got all the triangulation. I've actually come across his name in terms of his theologian work, because I had been researching the Jesus seminar business, which, as you mentioned, is more towards the historical Jesus. So I'm delighted to learn that someone who can be so focused in one area can also hold down the fort both in rock and roll and the mythos of the dark universe as well.
All right. With no further ado, Robert Price, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Oh, it's great to be here. Great to talk to both of you instead of just hearing you on other shows.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. And, you know, I guess the place I want to start is I want to get a little autobiography out of you, just in terms of your, you study theology, you study New Testament, you go out, you become a preacher, and then that sort of shifts and drifts and transforms into the kind of work you're doing now. And so I'd really like to hear a little bit about your own journey through Christianity, but particularly as you come to change and redefine what it is that you do in relationship to the still flowing current of theology.
Well, I always used to say when I would introduce Hinduism in my world religions courses that it's a living museum, that every, as far as we can tell, anything and everything that has ever thrived in Indian religion is still there, though it may have changed a bit over through the years by way of adaptation. Well, I find now on reflection the same is true of my own life, that really there is nothing I've ever been interested in that I've completely dropped. As a little kid, I loved Superman and the comic book heroes, Spider-Man, and so forth, and I still do. I'm a fanatical superhero fan and all that. I got interested in Jesus and God and Christianity, I guess, when I was about 10 years old or so, and I've never really lost that either, though I now think that belief is really beside the point, and I don't have that, but it just makes the engagement with religion all the more interesting. When I was about 12, I got into H.P. Lovecraft and other pulp authors like Lester Dent, Robert E. Howard, and so on, and I've always remained in that. It never mattered to me whether any of it really fit. I can see broad commonalities, but so general that I guess it doesn't really unify them. And I think of what Helena Ekdahl says at one point in the great Bergman movie Fanny and Alexander. She says that that reality shattered, and she doesn't bother to put it back together because it somehow feels better this way. And I figure, yeah, what the heck, I just pursue all of these things. Well, I became a committed, born-again Christian when I was about 10 years old, and I got deeper and deeper into it, and I discovered apologetics, the business of trying to show that, yeah, the Bible is all true, there really is a God, we know Jesus existed, he rose from the dead, you ought to believe in the Bible, and so forth. I went to, I majored in religion and in history at Montclair State College, and then went on to Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary just to study New Testament, really. I didn't get a ministerial degree. But then went on from there to take a PhD program in systematic theology at Drew University. And by this time, I had decided that I just couldn't buy conservative traditional Christianity. I still found it fascinating, but I just thought that the stuff I had thought buttressed the case for it really was just spin. It was just full of holes. And so I sort of got off the one team, but explored other things like Paul Tillich, Rudolf Bultmann, and other more radical theologians. I was kind of a religious agnostic, I guess, and then I discovered a church with a really intriguing, fascinating pastor who was deeply committed as a Christian, but also completely open-minded and would talk about Socrates and Kierkegaard as much as the Bible. And I thought, oh, man, I don't know what I believe, if anything, but I got to get some of this. And a few years later, I got when I finished this theology degree, I got a job teaching religion in down here in North Carolina at Mount Olive College, and started going to the Episcopal Church. I figured, well, I'm not going to get the intellectual challenge I got in that church, but I love the poetry of the liturgy and all of that. I figured that's another way of being nourished spiritually. Well, a few years after that, the pulpit came open in the Baptist church, the liberal Baptist church I had gone to, and I became pastor of it and moved back to New Jersey. And since I was near my old grad school, Drew, I decided to enroll in a second PhD program, this time in New Testament. And reading some of the pioneering biblical critics and getting back into that sort of rationalist state of mind, and then fortuitously in discovering the writings of Don Cupid and of Jacques Derrida, I began to undergo even more of an intellectual shake-up. I remember once reading a book on deconstruction. I was waiting for the bus, I think. I suddenly got something that Derrida had said that I hadn't before, and I had the image of somebody screwing the top of my skull off, reaching down and rearranging the contents of my brain. I suddenly got it. And I eventually, a few years later, left the church amid a schism, and did a house church for another 6 years, and then moved back down to North Carolina. So I've worked for the Council for Secular Humanism. I am an adjunct teaching for Johnny Coleman Theological Seminary, which is a New Thought outfit. And now I write in all of these areas. I've got a bunch of fiction anthologies out with more coming. I've got various historical or non-historical Jesus books in the works and from different publishers.
Let's move in on the. I got a couple questions from that nice life capsule, but one is just this description you have about deconstruction, and I really appreciate it, and I also appreciate in your latest book, Preaching Deconstruction, where you bring deconstructive ideas to bear on the reading of biblical texts, and particularly the form of the sermon, because they are sermons, and I want to ask about that again also in a moment. But, you know, when we say deconstruction now, like a lot of people go, oh, ho-hum, oh, the postmodern, this and that, blah, 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 abstract theory, endless, you know, meaningless hair-splitting debates, a lot of jargon, et cetera, et cetera. And all that's true to a degree, but there's a core, I don't want to say maybe core isn't the right metaphor, but there is a thread to deconstruction that is world-shifting, that does blow your mind, that does change the way you see the world, see meaning, see things in a process that might be somewhat stark sometimes, somewhat alienating perhaps, but is also playful and fecund in a lot of ways, as well as being insightful and also up for grabs. There's still major questions about what exactly Derrida was up to, and particularly, I want to emphasize the question of religion. In fact, from my perspective, by far the most interesting application of deconstructive ideas is to the questions of religion, both the nature of religious texts, questions of mysticism, and particularly the via negativa, the approaches to God that involve the avoidance of all kinds of positive claims in the way that the deconstructionists encourage us to pursue. But there's something very visceral about it that comes through both in your description right here and in your own writings. It's very accessible, it's very sensible, it's not some abstract kind of jargon. What is the core of that for you? What are those, we can't help but fall into the old language of essences. What are the essential elements of deconstruction that motivate you as someone thinking through religion and thinking through the meaning of religion?
Well, for one thing, it makes me think of something Paul Tillich said, who was really, of course, pre-deconstruction, but the most fundamental thing he thought we could say about God is, and the only non-metaphorical thing, is that God is being itself. And then he defines it and says being is the affirmation of itself over against non-being. Well, I think that is very much fundamental to deconstruction, because it says that all estimates, all sketches, all schemes of meaning are really resting upon a void, because they cannot be anything other than linguistic in nature. And language does not really describe things. It doesn't just point to them. It doesn't signify. Language really is, it gets its meaning from the way words fit into adjacent words, like jigsaw puzzle pieces, that you, there's nothing outside language, Cupid says. And I think that that's kind of what Tillich was saying, though he didn't get the implications yet, that everything is a kind of a dance over the great void. And this coincides, I think, most clearly with Buddhism, where it says we're really talking existential issues here, not essences and so forth. And it says, what is enlightenment? At least in Mahayana Buddhism, like Zen Buddhism, you're trying to get to the thusness of things, the suchness of it. Well, Derrida talks about how we see reality always pre-inscribed, that there's meaning written all over it. So everything we are born and raised to believe and think and perceive is already defined by our ancestors and our parents and so forth. And so deconstruction means to point that out and to say, well, that's the way it's going to be, but it's worth seeing that that's what it is, a kind of superficial layer. And so what is the implication of that? That you could possibly manage to look around this wordplay and get a vision of suchness. There wouldn't be any content to it. That's sort of the whole idea. But there would be this Buddhist-like enlightenment of pure suchness. It's not a thing. There's no ontological ground, a God who on whom everything is based. But it's worth a try to have this shock of getting beyond the words, which substitute, Buddhist style, for reality. We think we know something because we have a lot of words and concepts, but they don't convey reality. They hide it. And even reality is not real. It's just the blank slate. And that, to me, that is the real central, though, again, like you say, you're really not supposed to say things like central insight, but to me, that's the most startling thing about it.
Well, I can understand why those ideas, if you want to think about them religiously, and through religion, that why they make sense from a Buddhist point of view. You can meld or overlap some deconstructive moves with a Buddhist account, but you're largely have done so in the context of Christianity, and not just in a critical mode, meaning you're not just saying, look, obviously if we apply deconstruction to biblical texts, the traditional views can't sustain themselves, there's no there. Let's just stop. You don't do the let's just stop. In fact, you say, let's keep looking. Let's return to the text. Let's return to the sermon. And indeed, these deconstructive essays in the latest book are sermons. And yeah. So I'm really wondering, as someone who went through born again, traditional Christianity, more liberal Christianity, or radical Christianity, to a point of sort of post-Christianity, what is the meaningfulness of the form of the sermon, whether or not it was something you discovered as you did this home churching or just in your continued practice, what is it about that form, that return to a certain kind of religious talking, even if your own positions are in some sense now in the margins of religion?
Well, my predecessor, a man named Don Morris at this church, who's preaching really grabbed me, he would often refer to Socrates and the Socratic method. And I guess somewhere along the line, oh, and he would always say that, a la Kierkegaard, that the very idea of a sermon implied some sort of authority on the part of the speaker, which he did not believe he had, so he came to start calling his Sunday morning addresses talks or one thing or another. Well, I think that is true, too. I cannot even, I just cringe at the idea of telling people what to think and exhorting them because I know best. That's out of the question. But suppose you took the role of a Socratic midwife, and I do this in any kind of sermonizing I still do, which is almost none now, but also in teaching. I am trying to expose people to new information they may not have encountered, new perspectives, new possibilities, and about the text and what it may mean and problems in theology, all this kind of thing, so that they can incorporate whatever insights they get into their own ongoing synthesis. That's all I'm doing, and I obviously do not think I'm ever going to come up with a capital T truth. Truth, I think, is more like the North Star. It's a coordinate you navigate by. Or, like you said, an apophatic negative theology. You may not actually be able to say anything about God, but at least you can disabuse yourself of grosser illusions about it. Well, same thing here. I don't think I'm ever going to come up with a definitive synthesis, but it's worth clarifying, and therefore I don't try to convert anybody to anything I think, even in the books I write. I'm saying you come up with your own synthesis. You keep working on yours. If I can be of any help fueling the fire, that's all I want to do. And so to me, that is very appropriate to the notion of deconstruction. I've done sermons with titles like The Spirituality of Inquiry, that I think that the spiritual yearning in any religion is the fulfillment, because you're seeking after the infinite, which you can never contain. And the same is true intellectually. The only way to grow is to stretch and to realize what you don't know and to keep at it, whereas answers, whether somebody just fed them to you or you came up with them, they're like sleeping pills. Now you're satisfied and you're going to start snoozing and maybe you'll never wake up, you'll be complacent. I don't want that. I want to keep doing the Zen slap and getting people to think, oh yeah, geez, I never thought of that, and maybe I will think about it, and so on.
Well, and let me ask you this, because I feel like that's really an important key that gets left out so much, is just presenting that environment and making an invitation for that modality of freedom and expansion and growth in the mind to occur. It's kind of like, even when you just kind of set or open that kind of space where people can ask questions and go on those seekings versus places where they're told absolutely to not ask questions and just believe things and just, you know, like you said, take sleeping pills. So in your experience, do you find that when you open those spaces and allow for those freedoms and those kind of questions, because, I mean, the only thing I can think of, right, is people would not want those environments because they're threatening for some reason, like people actually feel like a threat if those kind of things occur. Do you find when you're actually doing it with people that they'll open and grow and ask those questions, or do you get, like, threat reactions, or do you get a little bit of both?
Oh, definitely both. I might be teaching at one of the schools I went to if some students hadn't complained, some religiously conservative ones. Though there's another place, another seminary, where I wasn't politically correct enough for some people because I didn't follow the school's rule of referring to God as female half the time. And I tried to show how this was a gross error from the standpoint of deconstruction and so forth. I've definitely got the opposition I expect, but I've been so happy over many years to see people just light up, and now even at their cost, problems they began to sense immediately once they, as I like to call it, hoisted up the cross of truth and began to suffer for it. But I love Gnosticism, and not really the Gnostic answers, it's all sort of crazy mythology, though I love it, but the Gnostics said, let's not rot people's boats, because if they're not ready for it, we're just generating pointless, dangerous controversy. But let's keep an eye out, sort of like Diogenes. Let's see if there's somebody who is dissatisfied with a conventional view and knows there's got to be more. Well, if there is, we can say, yeah, you're right. Here it is. Here's something to think about. And that has been so great, and even from the from not just talking to religious people that are feeling confined by it, but through my Bible Geek podcast that I've been doing for years now, I constantly am told by people that, let's say, never had any interest in the Bible, or they did as fundamentalists but dumped it. They say somehow they got to listen to my podcast, and it's created in them a renewed interest in and love for the Bible. Sort of like atheist secularists and all that. And I just love that, because I think believing in any dogma is beside the point. It even undermines the spiritual adventures you can have, and it puts on the blinders. So do you have to believe in it? What the heck? Do I have to believe in Zeus to appreciate the Iliad and Greek mythology? Do I have to believe there actually was a Hamlet prince of Denmark to get something out of that? No. And so, yeah, I've found both the negative and the positive, and there's no way to avoid the negative to get the positive.
Well, for me, one of the things, and I suspect you'll agree as well, is that there's a peculiar and specific kind of density to the Bible, both the Old and the New Testament, in terms of that for you know, centuries, for millennia, people have been reading and rereading and reframing and paraphrasing and interpreting and deconstructing and overconstructing the meaning of these particular texts. So they're incredibly rich and dense with possibility. And, you know, the literature alone, the you know, academic literature on the Bible is just, you know, enormous. Just it's like mind-blowing how huge it is. But even leaving aside the sort of, you know, the endless labyrinth of study, it sort of invites you into this kind of Borgesian world where all perspectives are articulated and linked, and yet there's still room for more. It's almost like a kind of infection you get. And the way in which even very religious people will use the Bible, will cite scripture, and really great, you know, I love great preachers who are able to synthesize citation on the fly and be able to weave these dense connections between different points of doctrine or different figures or different images. It's just an incredibly rich world regardless of your belief in it. And there are always new ways into it, and I can see that in your in the new book. There's some wonderful turns that you take on very familiar passages from Corinthians or Lamentations, things that I've read before, and I'm like, oh, there's still something sort of new there, but it creates this vast labyrinth that I think is very appealing just on an imaginative and intellectual level, again, leaving aside the question of whether or not you might find a particular answer. And I'm often saddened in our sort of post-religious age or post-Christian age where so much of the zones of culture and of politics that I'm interested in, most keyed into, most of the people who inhabit those worlds have sort of left this whole tradition behind, and I find it remains incredibly valuable. And so that's a kind of a question for you. Do you see, is this just happens to be what you're still interested in, what you teach, what you want to write about, or do you see that there's something valuable particularly about the Bible and returning to the Bible, even from a post-Christian, post-religious or point of view?
I think there is. I don't fault anybody for feeling indifferent toward it. There are many other great resources out there, so I don't say, I try not to be a spin doctor for the Bible. Oh, yes, we should all be interested in the Bible, because even if I don't believe it, it's still good for this reason. No, it might or might not be, but I think it often is. I remember some years ago hearing Jerry Brown on, I think he had a talk show long ago, and he explained how that you couldn't really understand certain things about government and society without mythological categories like the principalities and powers that are mentioned in the epistles. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but principalities and powers, forces of wickedness in the heavenly spheres and all that. And Brown said that, I think this is what he meant. He didn't gust on interminably like I do, but where do you locate these super individual, super personal forces that seem to rule the world, corporate entities, governments, public opinion, all of these things that are far more than a bunch of individuals? Peter Berger gets into this with reification and all of this. That, well, the only category, and like these are things that one can, no individual can change. They're so entrenched, created by humans, but now so much vaster and more powerful. Well, this is very much like what the ancients thought of as these fallen angels that govern and give structure to the world, but given the kind of world it is, they're going to be as corrupt as the world, and yet it's better than chaos. And I thought, yeah, here's a guy who gets it. It was existential concerns that brought about these mythic awarenesses. Or like I just said about Gnosticism, they had all kinds of views no one would defend, least of all me, but they had this idea of what the spiritual quest was and how to help people in it. So I think that the Bible does have an awful lot of that, as well as just practical wisdom. I mean, the Bible is not, as some of my atheist buddies seem to think, Mein Kampf with a leather cover. It's there's a lot of bad stuff in it, but you'd expect that with any book. As to the ever-growing fecundity of this, the rabbi said that God said to the Torah, be fruitful and multiply, and so that there are all these levels of meaning and redaction and hidden messages, like in the Dead Sea Scrolls, they interpret the Bible in ways relevant to them that we never would have thought of. And this is why the movie Noah is so terrific, in my opinion. I mean, it's well written and great effects and all that, but people say, oh, this is not biblical. Well, it is and it isn't. It's based on the very short passages in Genesis 6 through 9, but what Darren Aronofsky did, an atheist, by the way, is to look into all the lore that embellished this story, from the Talmud and the Kabbalah, the Jewish pseudepigrapha, almost everything in that movie, no matter how weird, is taken out of this subsequent reception history of the text, and that is just so fascinating. It is a living tradition even now.
Well, this is wonderful. I'm bursting with questions, but we got to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're speaking with Robert Price, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with you today. We are speaking with Eric Davis and Robert Price about religion and many, many other things. Hopefully we can move into Cthulhu too, but I wanted to, before we head in that direction, just briefly, what you were talking about before the break was so fascinating to me in terms of seeing like the principalities relating to fallen angels and also to these paradigms or structures that we seem to get kind of stuck in terms of human thought levels and consciousness. And I had a revelation in terms of the names of the angels and how they're named, like Michael, for example, who is like God, and that they're more like questions, and that a lot of these things described in religions of all kinds, these hierarchies, become more like questions we can arrive at where we kind of like experience different levels of our brain. And the way you just described it, it's almost like you could think of religion as an amalgamation of human reactions to reality, in that sense, where the scripture becomes like, you know, well, this is the consciousness level that reacted to this particular situation, and then it becomes like an archetype in the world. And I was wondering if, in your experience, experience with kind of navigating these different hierarchies and structures, and like you said, the paradigms, if do you feel like you have seen any kind of collective, I don't know what the word you would use is, maybe like progress, but again, you can't really commodify it, but do you feel like some of our consciousness levels as a group in some of your deconstruction and research, do you feel those mutable and stretching and changing? Like, can we do like Socrates and just stretch it out a little bit?
Well, I do. I think there's all sorts of new insights, some rediscovered from ancient times, but new to us. But it's another case of where I'm afraid the Gnostics were right, that you just cannot expect that most people will ever even be interested in any of this, even very intelligent people and very moral people. This, I don't mean to demean them, but it's just almost impossible to imagine most people even thinking there's a need for this kind of thing. And I hope maybe the Mahayana Buddhists are right, and that one day in the far future everybody will wake up. But I find another irony here is that it seems to me that people who are attuned to greater intellectual and spiritual levels are often so, they seem to me anyway, so naive about pragmatic realities that they render themselves somewhat irrelevant, and they really are, we really are, I am, more otherworldly minded. I've always thought it's kind of funny that I'm not this worldly minded, but I don't believe there's another world either, but in one sense. So I think there's more and more, but whether we will ever as a species change collectively, I don't know, that's just so far off. Now we see in a glass darkly. I really have no idea.
Well, I'm going to take this sort of a somewhat, you know, different tack, but staying with this Gnostic idea. I think that one of the I'm kind of trying to triangulate a couple of threads here. You have that citation. I think it's from Ephesians with the powers and principalities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that idea, which is, you know, very much in New Testament, it's also resonates, overlaps with powerful Gnostic ideas, the ideas of the archons. So
yep.
Whether we think of the fallen angels or we think about the archons in a more Gnostic sense, there is this idea of sort of larger than human powers, not identified with God, constructing, controlling the world behind the scenes, which in our modern era we have tended to replace with abstract concepts like society or class conflict or capital, but also can manifest in a more mythological forms of, let's say, conspiracy, or the Illuminati, or demonic forces behind the record industry, things like that. So we see this sort of return both in a secular way with these sort of abstractions and with a kind of mythologized way. But see, we keep returning to the sense of these kind of larger entities. And this is, I'm setting up now the turn towards Mr. Lovecraft, because I'm wondering whether part of the appeal for you of Lovecraft and weird fiction in general is that it plays in a variety of ways with this sort of sense of a non-human entity that is perhaps more intimately close to us than we would ideally like. Or am I trying to fuse fragments that are better left somewhat distant?
No, I think that's correct. One of the very first articles I wrote back in the early 80s was called The Old One's Promise of Eternal Life, where just as a kind of an exercise in tongue-in-cheek scholarship, I took the couplet of Al-Hazra, that is not dead which can eternal lie, and with strange eons even death may die. And I said I thought that originally this, it appears in the Greek translation of the Necronomicon, and my guess is that it's a piece of liturgy or poetry from Gnosticism, and the strange eons refer to the ions, emanations from the Godhead, but understood as the archons, the fallen angel powers that ruled the world and so on. I was kidding around, but it was easy to make the connections. And I think in Lovecraft that is the case. On the primary level is Dirk Mozig, one of the greatest Lovecraft scholars ever, as he pointed out. The old ones, Cthulhu and Yog-Sothoth and so forth, they really seem to symbolize the forces of nature that are indifferent to us, even unaware of us, but which will destroy us as they've destroyed the dinosaurs and so forth. That our presence here is kind of an accident of being. It's ultimately significant to no one but ourselves, and it'll eventually, we will have our turn and we'll be off stage, and that these inexorable cosmic forces, like the sun eventually burning out and so on, that these things are symbolized as the old ones. Do they even really know about us? Are they enemies? Are they hostile to us? No, that's kind of missing the point. We can know about them, but it's bad news. And yet Lovecraft in the stories, which is a little bit of a different level, does connect this with religion and says that Cthulhu and the others had created religion through dreams to nudge the primitive human race to try to serve and set them free. And he implies that religion is in general the creation of these powers in a cynical way. I mean, there's no point doing a systematic philosophy of Lovecraft. I don't know if you could, but yeah, he seems to realize that there are these principalities and powers, these paradigms, these collectivities that we cannot control and perhaps cannot even escape. And in fact, I think Lovecraft opens up to I'm sure you know very well, though he later flirted with socialism, he was very conservative, even to the point of being a racist and so forth. He wanted to live in a previous century and in effect did. He talked in things like The Horror at Red Hook, The Call of Cthulhu, and so on, of the danger that Western rationalism, what we might call Eurocentrism and Logocentrism, is threatened by the return of the repressed, that non-Western superstition and extinct religions and passions and primitivism of various kind would eventually sink the West like Atlantis, and he didn't think that was a good thing. He saw it happening already. In a sense, what he said is coming about with an arsenal of philosophical justifications today. So I think he was very prescient in these sociological matters.
Well, let's stay on that point, because I does raise some really interesting questions. You know, I'm thinking here about the idea that you find in Strauss and neoconservatism of the noble lie, that the intellects of society, the deconstructionists on the one hand, and let's say the scientists or the neuroscientists on the other, understand that the conventional myths that sort of support mainstream reality are mythological. And the idea, the conservative idea of the noble lie, is that it's in the interests of everybody to kind of keep that stuff under wraps. You know, maybe there's a little discussion in the higher corridors of power, but basically you don't shake the boat, because even if the boat is an illusion, it's the only vessel we have. And if I thinking of the same passages you from the Call of Cthulhu, he's talking about this blessedness that the mind is not able to correlate its contents. The idea that if we were really able to put together all of the various factors of knowledge, that the resulting vision of the universe would be so implacable, so empty of human meaning, that it would just drive us crazy, literally. And this problem of nihilism, which you could go back, you know, to Nietzsche if you wanted to. And so it puts us in a very weird place, because, you know, that seems strange to hide this kind of thing. Nobody wants to do it. It's a strange relation. And yet there's some kind of truth to it. There's some sense that we are kind of actively participating in our own in the removal of foundations, and people are kind of trying to find some way to think around that. And how do you wrestle with that? How do you wrestle with the sort of I mean, you don't seem like a very nihilistic fellow. You're very creative. You're funny. You have a lively life. And yet there is a kind of nihilism or meaninglessness that's very frightening, both in a kind of deconstructive vein and in a scientific vein that's undermining all of these traditional religious narratives of morality, et cetera, et cetera. How do you think about this stuff?
Well, Lovecraft was already seeing this happen in the reaction to Darwinism, which we kind of thought was banished for a while, but now seems like a minority of people believe in evolution. That was a prime case of science offering revelations people just did not want to hear, because it implied that they evolved from lower life forms, God wasn't creating them, we're not the apex, we're the ex-ape. And so they were retreating into fundamentalism already. Yeah, that is definitely happening. But this notion that the elite knows better, but it wouldn't be good for the secret to get out, that's already the Grand Inquisitor's idea. That's already the view of the sophists who had gone beyond Athens and said, oh, what do you know? This isn't the only way people think of the world. I guess there's no one true way to think of the world, but if it's working, let's not upset the apple cart. It's better than nothing. And that goes back to the principalities and powers, that the world is run by a cabal of cosmic gangsters, but it's better than the war of all against all. And you find it in Durkheim that he implies religion is a kind of a hoax to maintain social order. Would it be better not to maintain social order? And again, it's Gnosticism. Judaism and Christianity, though they're not bad, are not really the truth. They're created by these angels, and so if you're a Jew or a Christian, conventionally you're really worshiping angels, though you don't know it. But only a select few will understand that and be in the position to go beyond good and evil and not use it as an excuse to do evil. I mean, if you're still sinning, you're not at that point. And to me, it all comes down to the joyful knowledge or the gay science of Nietzsche, that there isn't any truth as we used to define it. There are only competing fictions. And the world as a void ought to be understood as a blank slate, an empty canvas that is left to us to fill with whatever beauty we can lend it. And so we create the meaning of our lives. So I guess I'm kind of a Nietzschean and an existentialist. I'm a little daunted by the idea of not being here one day, but in a way, death is the period that prevents life from being a meaningless run-on sentence. Life is precious because we have our turn at it, and then it's over, and we should graciously retire and say, okay, it's my kid's turn now. And I think the Bible even says that, like in Psalm 90, parts of the Bible have no notion of personal immortality, and they're okay with it. So yeah, there is no ultimate meaning. There's no ultimate right and wrong. But as Aquinas admitted, you don't have to have eternal objective standards. It's a question of what works. You need a social contract, and all societies have seen that, which is why their core values have always been the same, though different in application. And so there's no society that's going to say, yeah, let's have open season on murder. What do you say? It's never going to work. So there's never been such a society. And what does God have to do with it? Well, Aquinas said he created us as the people we are, so that these are the things that will work and not work. Well, even if you don't think there is a God, the point is the same. Do you want to live in a chaotic society? No. People seem to worry that if there's not some heavenly bureau of weights and measures, then all is chaos. No, it's not. I mean, you might not be able to win a philosophical debate with Charles Manson and convince him what he's doing is wrong, but really, does morality depend on that? It's like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
Let me ask you this question, too. How then would you kind of reconcile or think about that in terms of nature and, like, the natural world, okay? So, like, not thinking about human beings, per se. Obviously, there's all the philosophy and rhetoric about all those things you're saying. But then you can also compare it to how the reality of how the world operates and other beings. So would you say that human species is held in or has that capacity because they can differentiate and distinct that from, like, just random murder, which, I mean, you could arguably say happens in the natural world, right? You're looking at orcas that would just kill for whatever, you know, you could find examples if you look. But do you think there's a visible, real difference between humanity in terms of those rules and the rest of nature in terms of those rules?
Yeah, I see that as a dividing line between natural selection and cultural selection. Well, that's why nature is red in tooth and claw, and we don't blame a bear for killing a deer or whatever. This is why the Lion King was so funny. Some of the animals talk, but then Mufasa's going out to have a couple of gazelles for lunch. They don't talk because they're just the stars of the show are really humans wearing animal costumes. Well, we have gotten beyond that because of our big brains, and now we can make decisions that shape evolution and survival. And we ought to be able to see that the same pragmatic social contract kind of arrangement we make, we have to have with the world. As Mr. Spock said in Star Trek IV, it's not logical to hunt a species to extinction. I mean, there's nothing about animal rights entailed with that. It's just stupid. And it's stupid for our sake. I mean, you don't even have to get to the question of the welfare of the animals, though we should. But even from a selfish standpoint, we ought to realize, yeah, maybe we better curb this or that. We don't do a great job of it. At least some people don't. And so you have to, it's like criminals in human affairs. But I think we can draw those distinctions because we begin to call the shots at one point.
We just got a few minutes left here, Robert, and I just wanted to actually just give you the floor a little bit to hear a little bit about what you're doing. I know you do a number of some different podcasts. You got a website. You're working on different books. This is just sort of a space for you to let us know how to keep up with you.
Well, I do the Bible Geek and the Human Bible, which I started for the Center for Inquiry, the Secular Humanists. I'm now becoming the theology fellow of a thing called the Global Secular Council, which I know sounds sort of like a James Bond villain group, but I hope to write and speak some for that outfit, it's a think tank, etc. But I am writing stories and I'm working on some books, one called Moses and Minimalism. I proposed one where I kind of do a friendly critique of the work of Bart Ehrman on New Testament criticism. I have one, I proposed to another publisher called Christ Mythicism and Gospel Christology. I've been approached to do a sort of a historical thing called Atheism in America. And then I'm doing one called Holy Fable, the Bible Undistorted by Faith, which would be sort of a critical introduction to the whole darn Bible. I have a 5-volume set of Lovecraft, all of his stories and some of his poems with introductory and analytical essays on each bit of it that I think maybe Chaosium is going to put out eventually.
Oh, I was wondering about whether you were going to have a sort of, you know, larger collection of the Lovecraft material gathered. That seems to be good. There's so much writing on Lovecraft, but again, I think that the religious questions are in some ways the most, or, you know, that the boundary between the religion and the nihilism is in some ways the most pertinent questions that we continue to ask. So I'm glad to hear that's going to be out there as well. And then, of course, there's the website, robertmprice.mindvendor.com.
Yeah, that's got this huge archive of, so it's great for folks with insomnia. It's got this archive of stories, essays, sermons, book and movie reviews, and all kinds of stuff I've written over the past years.
That's wonderful. Well, thanks so much for joining us. I felt like we only began the conversation, but that's often how it feels here in Expanding Mind.
Okay, what an honor. I appreciate meeting the both of you.
All right. Well, from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.